Hello and welcome to Worstfoot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host and our guest, propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. What are little boys made of? Snips, snails, and puppy dogs' tails. That's what little boys are made of. What are little girls made of? Sugar and spice and all things nice. That's what little girls are made of. What is Worst Foot Forward made of? Well, it's a mixture of the worst things in the world. There's a pinch of animal torture, the darker sides of various global cultures, the more aggressive elements of Christian fundamentalism, and obviously lashings and lashings of Nazis. That's what this podcast is made of. And alongside me is the snippiest, snailiest, puppy dog tailiest little boy I know, Ben Vandervelde.
Oh, what a delight to be part of your fairy tale recipe. I feel like I'm starting this show peeking out of a witch's cauldron.
Yeah. Yeah. You're quite a good cook. You've had your moments. What's your sort of go-to ingredient, like your secret ingredient that you zhuzh up a meal with? Or
I'm an all-right cook, but bearing in mind, like, obviously being the son-in-law of a professional cook and the husband of a professional Italian, I'm really not as good a cook as I think. And I can't do the thing that, you know, there's certain foods from certain cultures where they basically take one ingredient, in the case of my father-in-law and my wife, a tomato or tomato sauce, seem to do very little to it, and it comes out the other end absolutely delicious.
Yeah.
And I cannot do that. But my...
Seems like cheating.
Yeah, exactly. My current speciality, my two go-tos are either preserved lemons... Because I've discovered an amazing thing where I make chicken with artichokes and grapes in a tagine with preserved lemons, and it is the business. Or Thai fish sauce, because Thai food is the best food on the planet. And Thai fish sauce, don't read the ingredients label, because my it's disgusting, but add that to pretty much any stir fry and you become a genius.
Great. So what we've learned there from the Thai fish sauce is called Ben has a very international palate, and from the preserved lemons, Ben has moved to Southwest London recently.
Two things. Firstly, I've moved to Southeast London, and secondly, like, that's part of Middle Eastern culture, and the Vandervelds are proud Middle Eastern family that have lived in the Levant for centuries. And also, it's the sort of cookery you can do with a toddler, which takes ages and they feel really invested in without breaking anything in the kitchen.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, I think if you make the children cook for themselves, they have more of a skin in the game to actually finish the food.
Don't put your children's skin in the game.
Yeah.
And also, I will not be lectured by a man whose food culture is the Tato crisp.
I will be talking about potatoes later on. You better believe it.
Yeah, I absolutely do. Before this turns into all-out cultural warfare, as the British government would desire, I think it is best that we introduce this week's guest. He is a highly acclaimed, award-winning professional poet, performer, and educator who uses poetry to develop literacy skills, inspire confidence, and creativity in communication. And he's worked all over the country in hundreds of schools, libraries, theatres, and festivals. He's had books published by Bloomsbury and other major publishers, and has written and performed for the BBC. He's described as very imaginative and wonderful by the Sunday Times, magic by Michael Rosen, and a survivor of that god-awful comedy club for kids gig in Guildford by me. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the podcast, Joshua Siegel.
Hello, how's it going?
Very good indeed, thank you. Thank you for...
Someone's been looking on my website and seeing the things written there.
Someone has been looking on your website and seeing the things written there, because, Joshua, compared to the usual comedians and actors that we have on the podcast, someone's website is easy to navigate and up to date.
Oh, yeah, I do. I am very anal, if I'm allowed to say so, about keeping my website up to date. To the day, pretty much. I try and keep it up to date.
Getting your website up to date is the perfect way of avoiding doing anything creative. I know that's a procrastinatory game.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's the cop-out job.
Yeah. Now, I think you are one of maybe two or three professional poets that we've had on this podcast, and it's a delight to have someone on the show whose job is even more gossamer thin in the telling your uncle what you do for a job over Christmas dinner steaks.
Absolutely. And I always get roped into, if ever there's a family event, actually in a couple of weeks, it's my grandparents' 60th wedding anniversary. And I don't think I'll get away from that without being asked to write a poem.
Oh, you're like appointed family laureate.
Exactly, yeah. And I mean, you know, one of my uncles is an accountant. I don't ask him to do my accounts. Yeah. So,
do you know what? I feel like as a comedian, I get the whole, ooh, you could do a turn bit. And I don't, I'd like to think if I was a professional poet, the stakes wouldn't be so high because I get up to tell some jokes. There's at least three grisly old Jewish great uncles going, yeah, he's all right, but he's not Jackie Mason. But no one, no one's listening to you going, he's all right, but he's not Larkin.
No one reads any poetry anyway, so whatever I do is, you know, people don't generally have a point of comparison unless they're very well read.
Yeah, I feel like poetry in school is basically to give you something to drop into conversation for the next 60-70 years of your life. That's it. For most people, the most people who don't read poetry are just like, well, they'll keep quoting "they fuck you up, your mum and dad," or something.
Yeah, exactly. That's pretty much the one line of poetry I remember from. But no, Philip Larkin is basically what got me into poetry. I did study Philip Larkin for English Literature A-level. And yeah, it's totally miserable, very misanthropic, and it totally spoke to me as a teenager.
As a teenager, you shared Larkin's passion for pornography, presumably. So,
and for three women at once. Yeah. Or was that a thing he did? I know he did have three different partners. I don't know if they were all at the same time. But knowing what a shit he was, it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah. Do you find when you're teaching kids poetry, you have to go, anyone can write poetry, and then find yourself questioning the skill level of the job you have taken? There is a tension between, like, when you're trying to convey the love of art to other people, you're going, anyone could do this. And
yes,
going, wait,
yes.
But if anyone could do this, why am I doing it?
Exactly. Yeah, I think it's difficult. I think everyone has the capacity to access their imagination and to come up with interesting ways of using language. Obviously, to say that everyone can do something is to kind of belittle that discipline in a way. I think that with a sufficient level of practice and dedication, maybe anyone can develop a certain level of aptitude. But yeah, my aim when I go into schools is just to kind of convey the fun and possibilities of language, really.
It is wonderful because I'm noticing this in my son at the moment, who is starting to learn to play with words and just basically to, I'll say a word, I'll say, I don't know, potato, and he'll go, no, daddy, not potato, nutato, futato, and just start like replacing letters in it and be like, all right, you do you, tiny Spike Milligan.
There has just been published and this kind of gets my goat slightly, so there was a book that's just come out, written of poems, published by a major publisher. I can't remember who they are, but they're pretty big. And it's a book of poems written by a four-year-old. And that gets my goat a bit because, I mean, professional poets wait decades often to have their first book published, if it's published at all. And then there's this four-year-old who comes out and gets this book published. That and also it's clearly a gimmick. It wasn't written by a four-year-old, let's be honest.
Yeah.
It was written by a four-year-old's mum or a four-year-old's editor.
Let's be fair, it was transcribed by a four-year-old's mum.
Yeah, well, yeah. I'm just being a bit cynical. As someone whose journey to publication was a couple of years at least. Longer than 4 years old, longer than this guy's been alive. So
Walker Books. It's a kid called Nadeem Shama Surgeon.
Okay. Well, it's a kid's mum, actually.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, it is. I think it's a little unfair to name him on the podcast because now our fans might try and hunt him down on Joshua's behalf.
And you know what? I'm sure, I could be wrong and he could be an absolute genius. And I should clarify, I haven't read the book.
Yeah. What? Let's rename this show, Let's Cancel a Four-Year-Old.
No, I want you and this four-year-old to be the new, like, Norman Mailer, William F. Buckley, like, literary.
We could have, like, a roast battle.
Yeah, you could have, just
He would probably win, actually. Four-year-olds are very inventive with insults.
My favorite thing about this is that you're having literary beef with a four-year-old who is completely unaware that he is in a literary beef with you.
Talking of literary beef, this is, you know, get ready for quite the creaking segue. I'd like to think of poetry more than any other kind of writing as a sort of recipe, you know, as putting together different ingredients into a recipe. And we've been talking about this week's show being World's Worst Ingredient. Are you much of a cook, much of a chef?
Not at all. No, I'm very, I'm competent, I think, but I'm incredibly lazy. And I can't stand washing up. I really hate it. And we don't have a dishwasher. So I will do anything I can to avoid having to wash up. And if that involves not eating in the first place, then so be it. And I'm lucky that my wife enjoys cooking and is very good. And you mentioned earlier secret ingredients. Mm-hmm. She's got three ingredients, salt, garlic, and butter, which make pretty much anything taste amazing.
Damn right. I would eat those as are. And yeah. So we've discovered that you're very good at delegating cooking to your more able spouse. But what is it that you're worst at in the world?
So I was thinking about this, probably drawing pictures of horses. I'm not a great artist generally. I did draw quite a lot in primary school. And actually, if I look back to some of the, it was comics mainly. It's actually quite impressive. Like, I couldn't reproduce now what I used to do then. But I'm vaguely competent at drawing at least kind of vague representations and things. I could draw something and it might not be a good drawing, but you can recognisably see that it's a house. Or I could do something and you could see that it's a bear or a snake. But I cannot do anything that even vaguely represents a horse. It's really weird. It's one of those things I just cannot draw.
Is it because the thing with the horses, because obviously there's lots of different animals with four legs and flanks, you know, a horse, a cow, a buffalo, a sheep, a camel, they're all the same sort of, in the same way that the Ford Mondeo chassis can be anything up to and including like a Jaguar. It's the horse's head, isn't it?
It's the head.
I think God was like, the same way a golf course designer might design a tricky dog leg hole. God just went, we're just going to make this a real tricky one. We're going to separate the artists from the maybes with this one.
But I don't know if anyone else has particular trouble drawing horses. Do you experience trouble with horses?
I'm not a very good drawer either, but I do know a lot of people who draw, and horses' heads and human hands are the two hardest things, they say.
The thing with the human hand is I can at least draw something that you could look at and say, well, that's at least an attempt at a horse's hands.
But a horse's hand?
Oh, no, not a horse. No, definitely not. I can never do a horse's hands. That would be weird. That would be very weird. I mean, a human hands.
So yeah. I'm going to throw it out right now. Listeners, both on and off our Discord, we would like you to submit your pictures of a horse's head to our socials and our email. But more importantly, we would like a picture of a horse with hands sent to us. So I started off looking at something that I loathe, but going on what I've said previously, I also quite like, which is anchovies. Absolutely cannot stand them. Think they are disgusting.
Oh, that's delicious.
Hate them. Hate them in a salad. Hate them in cookery. Have discovered that they are an essential part of Thai fish sauce, and I'm an absolute hypocrite. And I looked up, and I didn't realise that this is what was the main constituent of them, something called gentleman's relish, which...
Highly, highly euphemistic. Yeah.
Beat me to it, yes. It sounds like the sort of thing that an errant Victorian politician would whisper into the ear of a brothel's madam. What will you be having this week, Lord Melbourne? Gentleman's relish, please, your ladyship. It is also known, so it was It was created in 1828 by an Englishman named John Osborne, not the kitchen sink drama playwright of the 20th century who also happened to be a vampire, but a food purveyor from, Victorian times. He also gave it the name Patum Peperium, which is a mixture of Latin and Greek, and he did it to sort of give it extra heft as a commercial brand. And it is made of 60% anchovies, butter, herbs and spices. And it is made by Elsenham Quality Foods in England. And the secret recipe is withheld from all but one employee. So, In the words of a Highlander, there can
be
only
one. It's probably his gentleman's relish, isn't it?
Yes. And I'd like to
one very fertile, imaginative employee.
I'd like to hope that, firstly, that man has to live in a sealed safe within the Elsenham Quality Foods compound, and that, like the Dalai Lama, when he dies, like another gentleman's relish recipe holder is born with the knowledge already downloaded into him.
Do you think they have some like young baby trainee gentleman relish messiahs like the Dalai Lama? It's like a whole pool of them to choose from.
Yeah, absolutely. And opinions differ on how you should eat gentleman's relish. I believe what you should do is make some toast, spread it on, and then throw it in the bin. Barry, please enjoy your joke now.
Sorry, is the disagreement over spit or swallow? That's what I wanted to know.
Right, sorry, I thought you were going to say, how should one eat gentleman's relish? On your knees, willingly.
Oh, no, with relish.
And a gentleman.
And my biggest problem with anchovies, and I don't know why, but they're the sort of food that have been around for, millennia. They formed an essential part of a Roman food called, I think, garum, which was a sort of staple. And Roman food, they really like playing with sweet and savoury in the same dish. Kind of like Thai food, where they'll attack all four senses at once. But your average anchovy will often be packed in barrels of salt and left to mature for 18 months. And I don't know why. Like, I'll take cheese maturing for that long, but fish just doesn't do it for me.
Yeah, if someone says, oh, this is 100-year-old wine, you're like, delicious. 100-year-old anchovy paste. No, thank
you. Well, when I was doing a little bit of research for this, I discovered there's a Swedish dish. I don't know how it's pronounced. Surströmming. And it consists of fermented herring.
Yes.
And apparently it's so pungent that many people have to eat it outside because... indoors, it's impossible to get rid of the smell. And that sounds pretty, pretty gross, I've got to say.
Yeah, I think you're not allowed to take it on airplanes.
Yeah. And similarly with durian, which is a fruit in Southeast Asia, you're actually not allowed to take that on public transport.
Yeah, friend of the show, the durian, which has come up on a couple of podcasts. It came up on the okay, yeah. smell. And when I...
The official worst foot forward fruit.
Yeah, I think it's one of the things that tastes better than it smells. I'm sure Barry has enjoyed many gentlemen's relishes like that. But if you go to many places in Southeast Asia, instead of a no dog sign, you will see a no durian sign with a silhouette of a durian and a red circle with a slash through it.
But you very much are allowed dogs. So that's a slightly
racist. Oh, Joshua.
Yeah.
True in... Is it Korea that the dog eating festivals are?
Yeah.
My wife ate dog in Vietnam.
Is a National Enquirer headline.
Yeah. She said
a dog ate my wife in Vietnam is a Pornhub search.
Yeah. Do the no durian signs, the silhouette doesn't have a person with a leash leading the durian into the place?
Obviously, in Britain in the 1960s, the durians were the bottom of that list of no blacks, no dogs, no Jews, no durians.
Yeah.
Those signs always annoyed me that no Jews was at the bottom of those, because come on, we're in show business, we should be at the top of that listing. But that's... that's by the by. We're going to stay in East Asia for my next thing. So obviously, quite famously in China, there is the tradition of the century egg, which is a egg that has been fermented and kept for actually not a century, often just a few months, but disgusting. But I found a new and even more disgusting egg. Gentlemen, may I introduce you to Virgin Boy Eggs? Which
another excellent Pornhub search.
Another deeply illegal Pornhub search there.
Yeah.
If you go to Dongyang in Shejiang in China, there is a tradition of having eggs that are boiled in the urine of young boys. These boys are presumably under the age of 10, and it is a springtime tradition of the city where urine is collected from these peasant boys.
Do they have to be peasant boys?
That I don't know, but because obviously I don't know about the socioeconomics of that particular area of China at the moment. Now, I don't know whether proletariat urine tastes just as good.
Maybe there's different qualities in the flavours due to their diets.
Yeah, that's probably true. That's suddenly Gillian McKeith can get a separate job as a sommelier in China.
So when someone, there's a saying in this country, when someone annoys you says they really boil my piss in China, that's, well, that means they're an excellent chef.
Yeah. Well, there is. And we talked on World's Worst Diet about urine-based diets and quacks who believe in the medical properties of urine. Well, apparently that's quite a big thing in some areas of China. And it is so baked into the culture of this place that there is a well-known vendor who goes around sourcing the urine, a literal piss taker. Who will sometimes visit schools and have vials in the boys' toilets for them to piss into, to the extent that if a young man in this area of China is in class and needs a piss, the teacher will remind them to go and piss in the Virgin Boy Egg vendor's vial so they can grab it.
And does the piss collector come at like an appointed time each month or whatever?
Yeah.
So it's like time to visit the piss collector.
Children running from their houses excited going, "Mummy, my piss collector is coming."
Playing tunes.
Yeah. If a child is called Michael or Mickey, he's even more excited. He gets a double for both, take the piss and take the Mickey. I feel like this is a kink that got out of hand.
It does feel like it, doesn't it? But apparently it is, it's entirely kinkless. And the thing I read, and I think I could do with a bit more backing up on this again from any listeners who are family or from that part of the world, but apparently the Chinese food culture, in a way, sort of matches what I understand of a lot of Chinese culture. It's less to do about the recipe evolving and being perfected and more to do about how they always did it. It's about enhancing the tradition. And the tradition was, we did this in the past 2,000 years ago. They weren't wrong then, so why would we be wrong now to change it? Sorry.
I mean, you could apply that to child sacrifice.
Yeah.
You could apply that to...
the
hanging, drawing, and watering.
Yeah, well,
I don't think that something was done a long time ago is a good rationale for doing it now necessarily.
Yeah. Listen,
but then again, I have not tasted Virgin Boy's eggs, so maybe I'll change my mind if I were to do so.
You might do. I mean, listen, I think we both come from a tradition of, but we've done this for 2,000 years, and Moses wasn't wrong, so why should we be wrong? But I disagree with that notion. Shall I talk you through the recipe? First, you soak the eggs in the urine of young boys. Then the mixture is heated over a stove. After boiling, the egg shells will be cracked around the surface on the egg, and then the eggs are then placed back in more urine. The used urine is then replaced with fresh urine, and the process is repeated until the eggs become cured in urine. They are left to simmer for a day. And then at this point, you can add some herbs for the good it'll do. And then when finished, the egg whites will have turned a pale golden hue and the yolks will have turned green.
Wow.
Eat your greens.
Yeah. And one local man has quoted as saying, "The smell kills me. I feel like throwing up at the thought of it. It stinks." Meanwhile, the vendors describe them as fragrant. So clearly, the vendors lead a double life as estate agents.
Amazing.
But for my world's worst ingredients, I went to the world of super hot chilies. Mm-hmm. Because these get quite out of hand.
Are you going to teach us about the Scoville scale?
I am going to teach you about the Scoville scale, as developed by Wilbur Lincoln Scoville, who was an American pharmacist who in 1912 developed the scale. And it's an organoleptic test, which is a test which basically measures the individual experience on the senses of various substances. And I have... Sadly, I thought that Wilbur Scoville, great name, would have an interesting history to tell you about. But no, he was just a pharmacist in America. Before
famous person in past with nothing interesting to say about them, shocker, on Westwood Forward.
Yeah, I know, right? As soon as I was just like, oh, Scoville is an actual bloke, this will be worth 5 minutes. But no, just nice family man, paid his taxes.
Ate his gentleman's relish.
Kept himself to himself mainly.
Absolutely, yeah. Apart from when he was measuring chilies. And up until the 90s, the highest chili on the scale was either the Scotch Bonnet, which is something I think we'll all have heard of, or the Habanero. 350,000 Scovilles.
Yes. The bell pepper is about 100, I think. So that's
Yeah, absolutely. And that, you know, a Scotch Bonnet will hurt. Enter California farmer Frank Garcia, who decided to develop a new habanero called the Red Savina that came to 570,000 Scovilles, and that was believed. No one can go faster than that. If you're gonna eat a chili that is any hotter than that, you will have to have a man walking in front of you waving a red flag at all times. Until. After him came a chap called Paul Boseland, who was a researcher at the Chili Pepper Institute. That sounds like bullshit, doesn't it? In New Mexico State University.
Sounds like a really shit music school.
Yeah.
He visited India to collect specimens of ghost pepper, which I presume is like a pepper secret agent, that is also known as the Naga King Chili. The Naga King Chili. At the time he collected it, it was being studied by the Indian Army for weaponization.
Oof.
And when he studied this pepper, it measured over 1 million Scoville units. And as Boseland said, this kind of opened the floodgates.
Oh no, is this a, like, does a chili arms race then kicks off?
Absolutely. So, in 2006, the Dorset Naga claimed to be the hottest chili, according to Guinness. A year later, it was the Ghost Pepper. Then in 2011, the Infinity, then the Naga Viper, then the Trinidad Scorpion Butch Tea Pepper, which it's like it sounds like guys souping up their cars to overcompensate. And in 2012, the Trinidad Maruga Scorpion was the hottest, measured at 2 million Scovilles. And then we peak with the Carolina Reaper, which is quite controversial because, according to Guinness, that's the hottest. But it is very hard for them to get the correct scientific information on it. Now, these super hots, they could get as hot as 60 million Scovilles.
What?
Yep.
That's too many Scovilles.
Is this kind of theoretically infinite, or is there biologically a limit to how hot a chili could be?
No, biologically, that is how hot it could be. That is the hottest number of Scovilles that you could possibly have.
We've reached absolute Scoville.
Yeah, yeah. That's like the 0 degrees Kelvin of Scovilles, yeah. Or 1 million degrees Kelvin.
Has anyone ever eaten it?
In April 2018, a 34-year-old man ate an unspecified size of Carolina Reaper pepper in a contest, leading to thunderclap headaches.
Yes,
which has reversible cerebral vasoconstriction syndrome, which includes these headaches and neurological issues and sometimes seizures, apparently.
Yeah, wow. Real bad. I also found Paul Boseland described eating a Trinidad Maruga Scorpion that says, you take a bite, doesn't seem so bad. And then it builds, and it builds, and it builds, and it builds. So it is quite nasty.
Yeah.
I will conclude by saying it's going to be the Carolina Reaper, which I'm going to choose because that is the currently, it is currently deemed to be the hottest chili. It is 3.18 million Scoville units. Eating it has been described as a fruity taste at first, but then immediately turns to molten lava.
Oh, God.
So, if we get 3.18 million Patreon supporters, then me and Barry will eat a Carolina Reaper.
You're on your own, buddy.
The first thing I did was try to define what was meant by worst. You'll notice that was a kind of hangover from my degree in philosophy, which was all about basically defining words, as far as I could gather. So, yeah, I kind of thought of three ways in which the word worst could be construed. So it could be, as Ben mentioned, with anchovies, just something I subjectively happen not to like. Or it could be something which is weird and gross, such as the virgin boy egg. Or it could be something which is actively harmful, whether that's to the human body or to the environment. And I try to think of, well, if you think of those three things as a kind of Venn diagram, the very worst thing would be something that kind of fulfills all three categories. Yeah. Something I did find for the subjective thing, which is things that, you know, I happen not to like, is interestingly coriander, which is something many people love. It's very common in Thai cooking, I think. But I discovered there is actually a specific gene that some people have called OR6AZ, and it makes people highly sensitive to something called aldehyde chemicals, which are present in coriander. And basically, if you have this gene, then coriander tastes absolutely disgusting.
Yeah.
So when I eat coriander, it basically tastes of soap. I can detect it a mile away in a salad. So coriander's kind of grim for me. Even
I know, but you're in good company because I read this as well. And Julia Child, the brilliant, famous American chef, she in an interview with
cilantro though, don't they?
Yes, they call it cilantro. Yeah. In an interview with Larry King in 2002, she said it has a dead taste to her.
Wow,
a dead taste.
Yeah, but you're right. Some people just can't. That's about 20% of the population or something.
Yeah. And another thing which I happen not to like is I get a real... I dislike sweet things in savoury dishes and vice versa. Mm. I find that really weird. I know Ben mentions Thai foods. That's a really common thing to have that mixture of sweet and savoury. But raisins, the presence of raisins in a savoury dish is something I just cannot stand. So yeah, moving on to the, well, in terms of the weird, but neither of those things are particularly weird or gross. They're just things that I happen not to like. But yeah, I Googled weird foods and there's just so much stuff. It's just a veritable cornucopia of disgustingness. So for example, there's something called an isinglass, which is, it's used in the brewing process of beer. It's not actually present as a substance in beer, but it's used as part of the brewing process, and it's made of a dried fish bladder. And I'm not quite sure why that specific substance is crucial for that activity. A lot of foods, apparently, beetles are used in food coloring.
I just want to go back to the dried fish bladder, because that's so precise. Because with, I mean, I know you're about to talk about beetles, and it's quite easy to go, ooh, that looks colourful. Smash. Smarties. But with brewers, did they have some a dried fish carcass and be like, right, lads, we've got our Heineken. Let's go through the organs and add them one by one to see what.
Let's go through the animals and then go through each organ. Where in the list did they get to fish?
Do you know what? This art box now really isn't working.
I assume it's really ancient because I think beer goes back thousands and thousands of years. So it may be one of those things which is tradition. It's often hard to know how these, like, who first got the idea to pickle an olive.
Yeah.
There's a substance that's present in chewing gum called lanolin, which is otherwise known as sheep oil. And this is oil which is literally gathered from the secretions of sheep.
So two things there. Firstly, I think sheep oil makes a very nice side dish, the gentleman's relish. And secondly, when you say secretions, I mean, that's a word that in a court of law one could pirouette a case upon. Which particular secretion of the humble sheep?
You know what? I don't know. Let me have a look. Sheep oil. It's otherwise known as wool yolk, wool wax, or wool grease. And it is a wax secreted by the sebaceous glands of wool-bearing animals. Now, sebaceous glands aren't they the things that produce pus in spots? It's a microscopic excrete. So it's in skin. They open up into hair follicles and they secrete an oily or waxy matter called sebum. And if you collect that from a sheep, you get this substance called lanolin, which is present in chewing gum.
Okay, so this is essentially naturally occurring sheep hair gel going in my spearmint.
I don't know if it's present in all chewing gum, because presumably vegetarians need to be catered for when it comes to gum, which brings me on to my next thing, which is gelatin. Now, this is something which is collected by boiling various bits of animals and collecting something called collagen, which is a gel-like substance, and it's used primarily in sweets, I think. And I remember when I was young, I am Jewish, and I wasn't brought up to be particularly religious, but I was nonetheless brought up in a home that didn't consume pork. And a lot of gelatin comes from pigs. So one of the things that I was told as a kid, you're not allowed these sweets because they contain something called gelatin. And obviously, being a kid, I had no clue what this was, other than it was unkosher. If I was told that I wasn't allowed something, it made me want it even more. So as a kid, I used to think, has this got gelatin in? That is great.
I mean, a couple of things there. Firstly, that means that I think you're not alone in the, if I'm told I'm not allowed something, I want it more. God there, clearly not understanding the psychology of his creations. And secondly, I remember that because obviously lots of people tend to think that, when I say lots of people, dickheads, tend to think that pork is essentially kryptonite for Jews and Muslims, and that's not the case. You can't back us into a corner with a packet of pork sausages or a string of chipolatas and sort of... But I remember gelatin as a kid having this semi-mythical status of this strange phantom substance that could be anywhere. It might be in any food, unknowing, and it could strike me down when I was least expecting it.
Wine gums were to Ben as the Philosopher's Stone was to alchemists.
Right, exactly.
So, yeah, I nominated that as a potentially worst ingredient for several reasons. Firstly, it's disgusting. Like, the idea that boiling animal parts, you know, that just doesn't sound good to me. It also violates the sweet and savoury thing, because for me, animals are very much savoury. But gelatin is used in sweets, so that violates it's my own rule, but it violates it. And it's also it's unnecessary, because there is a vegan substance called agar, and I don't know where that comes from, but other than knowing that it is not produced using animals, and it produces exactly the same effects as gelatin. So it's immoral, it's disgusting, and it's unkosher. So that is a potentially... could be a worst ingredient. So I think what I'm going to have to go for is something called artificial trans fats. So trans fats are naturally occurring. In many ways, a moderate intake of trans fats is natural and unharmful, according to the Trans Fats Marketing Board. I just discovered that. But there's something called artificial trans fats, which occurs when vegetable oils are chemically altered to stay solid at a room temperature. And I nominated this because two reasons. There is no known health benefit whatsoever to consuming artificial trans fats. They do no good. Many substances Well, another candida I had could be ammonia, which is in high doses, it's can damage your brain. It's used in fertilizers, and it produces something called peat slime, which is from the produced from the offcuts of ground beef. So it's vile. It's bad for you. But it can, its presence in foods in very moderate intakes can actually be beneficial in as much as it fights E. coli. So a lot of these things which are weird, disgusting and bad can also have some good in some capacity. But artificial trans fats are one of those things which literally there is no known health benefits whatsoever to consuming them. They are in many things. They're in so much things. Baked goods, chips, pizza, basically anything delicious is likely to contain. Yeah, yeah. And they're incredibly bad for you. They are linked to an increased risk of heart disease. They sneak up unaware because most of the things which we enjoy or which I enjoy contain them. And they have no known health benefits.
In my mind, artificial trans fats sounds like someone's taken a fatberg from the New York sewer and slivered a thin slice of it like it's carpaccio or pancetta or whatever and melted it into your food. That is a really strong and unbelievably disgusting choice.
Yeah, that's what I'm going with. I would probably rather eat a slab of that than a Carolina Reaper, though. If I was forced to choose, I would go for a slab of New York Fatberg over a Carolina Reaper, I think.
Because we're talking about ingredients, I looked specifically at dishes where the name doesn't really tell you what's in the dish.
Gentleman's relish.
Gentleman's relish is an excellent suggestion, and you. So I want you to have a guess at what a bunny hug is.
A bunny hug?
Yeah.
Some kind of cheese.
Mm-hmm. Ben?
I'm going to say that a bunny hug is a muffin version of a Welsh rarebit.
Oh, I thought you were about to say mutton because it's a mutton pancake.
Oh, okay.
What's the connection with bunnies?
Literally no idea. Just the name they gave it.
Okay.
A bosom caresser.
A bosom caresser. Something to do with milk. Cottage cheese.
Just cheese again, Ben.
Oh yeah, that is cheese again. Cheese on the
bosom,
brain.
A bosom caresser. I think it's going to be some sort of trifle or jelly.
So you're sort of in the. I don't know why I think you're in the same sort of area. It's a cocktail. But it's got egg yolk in it, along with cognac, Grand Marnier, and Madeira.
And why is it called... do I want to know?
Because it's a cocktail, and they have to give them stupid names that make staggering...
Sex on the beach with a bosom caresser. Yeah. That sounds...
Yeah.
That sounds vaguely appealing, actually.
Yeah, right? I read about the imam fainted.
Imam Bayild. I know exactly what that is. That is stuffed aubergine. And it's vegetarian, and I know that because Turkish cuisine is... one of my favourites. Imam Bayildi is a big favourite.
A stuffed aubergine with garlic and tomatoes. And apparently it was so delicious when it was first served to an imam that he fainted with the pleasure of the taste of it.
Good. Thank you for the explanation, because otherwise I was about to ask is an imam fainting like a meme within Islamic culture? Like it's in fact, it, like the imam fainted feels like the
a punchline of a weird joke.
It definitely does feel like that. A rabbi and a priest walked into a bar. ... and then the imam fainted.
Imam fainted. Yeah,
it's the Arabian version of gentleman's relish.
Yeah. you get things like ants climbing a tree. That's a traditional Sichuan dish.
Oh, yeah. I have heard about this.
The tree is like a bean noodle thing. And the ants are little pieces of ground meat. And it can be served so it looks like they're little. It's like a trail of ants walking towards this tree. Bombay duck, I think a lot of people would have heard of as not duck. It's a fish. It's a lizard fish.
What? A lizard fish?
Yeah.
Wow.
Which is, according to this article I read, is a very ugly fish indeed. Mock brains. This is a wartime recipe.
Mock brains.
Okay. So brains apparently were quite a common dish in Britain in the early half of the 20th century.
Nutritional?
It's a cheap, nutritional and sort of fairly cheap source of meat and protein and stuff. And so mock, during the war, obviously rationing was in place. So mock brains is a recipe of a cup of leftover porridge, a tablespoon of self-raising flour, a small onion, one egg, a large pinch of thyme and some salt and pepper. You chop, basically chop it and mix it all together and you make like little rissoles. And they look a little bit like brain, shapes.
Mock brains is what you call cauliflower to get toddlers to eat it.
Yeah.
You think that would be more likely to get them to eat it?
Yeah.
They wouldn't want to, because I remember when I first discovered, I think I was about 5 or 6, that the chicken you eat is the same as the chickens in the farm. Mm. I found that disgusting. So
yeah.
would the idea of eating a brain appeal to a toddler? Although telling toddlers that broccoli is mini trees, that's quite cool.
Because they think they're a giant.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So maybe if you serve the cauliflower in like a hollowed out skull or something, a bit of red sauce on it, so they can like reach inside, pull it out.
Basically, what you have to do is show your toddler that really quite racist scene in Temple of Doom where they with cut the snake open and they eat monkey brains. And if they are disgusted and scarred and need therapy, don't go for the cauliflower brains. If they're like, that's so cool, apart from the cultural insensitivity, then you know to be a bit more creative with what you're serving them.
Yeah, that's fair. And Albany beef? Do you want to have a guess what Albany beef is?
Lamb.
That's a very good guess, Ben.
Pigeon.
It's a sturgeon.
Oh, wow.
So apparently in the late 1700s to mid-1800s, sturgeons were absolutely rampant in the Hudson River Valley around Albany, New York. And so they were given the name Albany beef because they were like the meat of choice in the area, in the same way that other areas of America where they'd have eaten lots of beef. This was the thing that they ate. And they're massive. Sturgeons like weigh up to 800 pounds. And obviously you get caviar from their eggs and so on. They can grow up to 8 feet in length. And they live to be 60 years old. So you get really good aged Albany beef
I love it. And also now we know if the First Minister of Scotland ever wanted to take a right turn into the Conservative Party, she could call herself Nicola Albany Beef. Which
yeah, exactly.
I think is a great Tory name.
It very much is.
You've got a comedy character there on your hands.
Yeah. Nicola Albany Beef.
Yes, late Baroness Nicola Albany Beef.
Yeah, apparently it was so like commonly eaten in this that Albany became renowned for it. Albany was nicknamed Sturgeondom, and its inhabitants were called Sturgeonites because of how much of this they ate. Nowadays, of course, sturgeons are endangered and they're trying to repopulate.
That reminds me of in northeastern America, New England, lobsters used to be incredibly, they were like a pest. They were so common that they used to be the staple food of very poor people. And in order to conceal the fact that they were reduced to eating lobsters, they used to bury the shells in their gardens. It's weird. And now lobsters are a huge delicacy. And oysters in Victoria, England, Charles Dickens used to say that you can, what was it? Like you can judge a plate. You can judge how poor a place is by how many oyster stands there are.
Absolutely.
So it's weird that oysters, food that is. Yeah, I wonder what epicycles there'll be in the future.
It's true. Yeah. There's oysters and Guinness is like as traditional an Irish meal as you could ask for. Heston Blumenthal was asked at a talk, like, oh, if we were going to different countries, what's like the dish that you'd eat in that kind of, and just said oysters and Guinness if you were in Ireland, like as a simple Irish dish. It's not the posh thing that people, I think, imagine it to be. If you want dishes with interesting, weird names that don't really tell you what's in it, you don't really have to look much further than the UK. And for international listeners, you're very welcome to be introduced to some of these. You'll presumably know all of these, but Welsh rabbit.
That's cheese on toast.
Yeah, because it doesn't have rabbit in it. In fact, there's a suggestion that, because some people call it Welsh rarebit, and apparently the suggestion is actually rarebit is a later thing that people started calling it to make it less confusing to people who thought it was a rabbit dish.
But rarebit's even more confusing because is that rabbit? Like, what is this word? It sounds a bit like rabbit, but it's not rabbit.
Well,
what the hell is this? The
first recorded reference to the dish was Welsh rabbit in 1725 in a in English. But then 1781 is the first appearance of Rarebit, or A-R-E-B-I-T. And in 1785, a couple of years later, a friend of the show, Francis Gross, who compiled a dictionary, he defined Welsh rabbit as Welsh Rarebit, which isn't really much of an explanation. And it's one of those dictionary explanations where you're like, well, what's Welsh Rarebit mean? And you go back and you'll say Welsh rabbit. It seems like a circular one.
But reminds me of my philosophy degree.
Yeah, Fowler's Dictionary from 1926, which is full of lots of jocular and funny definitions. It says, Welsh rabbit is amusing and right. Welsh rarebit is stupid and wrong.
That's quite damning, isn't it? Stupid and wrong.
Yeah. There's a suggestion that the Welsh rabbit as a name is it's what's called a dysphemism. It's like the opposite of a euphemism in a way. It's like making something seem vulgar. So the suggestion is that only stupid Welsh people would eat cheese and call it rabbit, basically. And Parson's nose.
Oh.
That's a bit of the chicken, isn't it? A bit of roast
chicken.
Yeah,
it's the sticky, it's the bum of the chicken. It's the last few vertebrae, otherwise known as the pygo style.
I would not like to meet the parson whose that was named after.
Well, I would.
Do you want to know about him?
Yes.
So the parson's nose, the back end of chicken and duck and turkeys have them as well. It produces the oil that the bird uses to preen itself. And Heston Blumenthal again says that, and a lot of other cooks say that parson's nose should be removed before cooking the bird because it's going to make the dish greasy or even bitter. And pygo style, the word is a Greek word meaning rump pillar. But the phrase parson's nose, and the reason that's the nickname for it, is there's a story about sometime around 1400 AD, there was a carpenter who was asked to provide new pews for the choir at St. Mary's Church in Nantwich, the English town. And apparently the vicar there was either quite slow in paying him or didn't pay him at all and jilted him. And so the carpenter apparently, as retaliation, carved a picture of a bird with the image of the vicar's face sticking his nose up in the air as like the rump. Like the rump of a bird looks like. So, and the carving is still there. You can still see it on the end of one of the pews in Nantwich, in this church in Nantwich. And so, because the bum of the chicken sort of sticks up a bit in the air, like the idea of a snooty-nosed vicar sticking his nose up in the air fits quite well.
Do you think any tourists go to Nantwich specifically to see that?
I again, listeners, send us a tweet with the photo of you at that particular pew. They apparently sell like postcards with the picture of this particular pew.
Okay,
at the church.
That sounds cool.
So there's a little small local interest in it, I suppose. Bubble and squeak.
Oh, that is fried potato with onion, something like that.
It's sort of a hash of leftover vegetables. That's, but the important bit is cabbage, because apparently cabbage is the bit that squeaks.
Okay, yeah.
That's
and the bubble comes from the frying, presumably.
Yeah, cabbage and potatoes with a bit of onions is sort of the most basic version of it. And the first mention of the name Bubble and Squeak is from an 1806 book called Mrs. Rundle's Cookbook, A New System of Domestic Cookery. And if you don't like calling it Bubble and Squeak, there was an alternate name for it, which is Rumble D Thumps.
Oh, wow.
What a name.
Amazing, right?
I think toddler would eat that, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, a toddler would eat Rumble D Thumps, but I think a toddler would also be afraid that that was the name of the person who lived under their bed.
But my favourite one of these is Bread Soldiers. Now, I don't know if this is a thing that people call them soldiers around the world, but you and I will know that, you know, thin slices of bread.
Dipped into egg.
Dipped into egg is the interesting bit, Josh.
But not century egg.
Not century egg. So imagine toasting some toast and then slicing it long ways so you get long, thin bits of bread, the toast. And soldiers are, as you said, dipped into soft-boiled eggs in Britain.
Could this I just suggest, really... if you dip bits of bread into a century egg, then it's actually forming a terracotta army?
Yeah.
the term soldiers of bread, it seems like it must have been around for ages, right? And the idea of dipping it into eggs and all of that. It's not till the 1960s that people start doing this.
Wow.
So in 1966, there's a novel by Nicholas Freeling called The Dresden Green, where he references toast being dipped into potato soup. Around the same time, there was a series of commercials for eggs in the UK, which you might have heard of, the tagline being, go to work on an egg. starring the comedian Tony Hancock. And there were sort of minute-long bits of Hancock ordering breakfast, eggs for breakfast in various different places. And there's one in particular set in his little studio flat where he has a housekeeper played by Patricia Hayes who's bringing him his breakfast. And he's apparently Hancock didn't want to do like all the tagline stuff and the benefits of the eggs. So she is playing very like knowingly breaking the fourth wall to camera and that saying how excellent eggs are for you, and they're full of protein and happiness is egg shaped.
Does she mention boiling them in piss?
She doesn't mention the piss thing, but she walks away from Hancock in one of these and Hancock goes, "Where are me soldiers? I can't eat without me soldiers." And then looks down and sees she's left him some toast with a little slice of, and there's a close-up at the end of the toast being dipped into this runny egg with the slogan, "Go to work on an egg." And apparently dipping the soldier into the egg was Hancock's idea. That may or may not be true, but the idea of people doing this with their breakfast egg completely took off and was popularized in Britain by this advert.
And do we know why they're called soldiers?
Again, no one's really sure. And it seems like Hancock calling them soldiers may be the first instance of this.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. So it seems like such an old-timey thing to do. And yes, very, very recent. I've got to get to my choice for the world's worst ingredient, but I did say I would mention the potatoes. And I want to talk about, briefly, Antoine Augustin Parmentier. And if people eat French dishes with the word Parmentier in it, they'll know that potato was going to be part of it. Parmentier was a prisoner of war in Prussia, and his prison diet consisted largely of potatoes, which the Prussians grew, but the French thought were, there was a superstition about them being poisonous, and they looked a bit weird, and they were fed to pigs, but not to people. But when he was freed, Parmentier then decided that he was going to take what he'd learned in prison in Prussia and try and solve the sort of cycle of you know, boom and famine that was going on in France at the time. There was a failed harvest in 1770, and the Academy of Besançon offered a prize for people who could try and figure out a way of, you know, overcoming the fact that wheat harvests were always, and grain harvests were always failing. Parmentier wrote an essay about potatoes called "Inquiry into Nourishing Vegetables That in Times of Necessity Could Substitute for Ordinary Food." And then he
snappy,
went,
okay. Snappy title.
But then it was like, oh, I've won a prize, and there was interest in this as a potential solution for, you know, feeding the masses. Obviously, having a healthy peasant class meant you would have lots of people working the land and in factories and soldiers and all of that stuff. So there were statewide benefits that the upper classes were interested in. And so he worked to build public awareness of the potato by inviting the likes of Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson to his potato dinners, where he would serve the potato in different forms over as many as 20 courses. And he got celebrity endorsements. He met King Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette. And apparently after his meeting, they were seen out and about at Versailles and other places wearing purple potato flowers in their lapels and hats. And they even gave him a plot of land.
I'm just imagining a 20-course potato meal.
It sounds like heaven.
Yeah.
Yeah. Until you get to the dessert. I don't want a dessert made of potato.
Yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't sound great.
But they apparently gave him a plot of land on the western edge of Paris in 1786 in a place called Sablon. And Parmentier tried to hype the idea of potatoes even more by hiring guards to guard the farm during the daytime, making everyone who walked by think, God, potatoes must be really valuable. And then the guards would clock off for the evening and he would let people steal potatoes so that they spread potatoes among the masses and get people going, yeah, okay, the terrible security in this place, we can steal more potatoes and spread the idea that potatoes are brilliant. When he died in 1813, he was buried in Père Lachaise in Paris, and his plot is still surrounded by potato plants.
So that sounds like the best ingredient rather than the worst.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I just wanted to contrast him with my world's worst ingredient, which is snake. Now, I've eaten snake and it's quite nice. But I think snake in certain contexts is a missed opportunity. And I have found recipes for viper soup.
Ooh.
This is from The Country Housewife and Ladies Director by Professor R. Bradley, 1728. Take vipers alive and skin them and cut off their heads.
Oh boy.
Already that first sentence, there seems to be a mix up in the order. Take them alive, skin them, then cut off their heads.
I mean, that's not a recipe. That's an instruction from a warlord.
Yeah. Then you slice them up into pieces, apparently, and you boil them with their hearts, and you make a a lovely soup with them. And the rest of the recipe sounds delicious. But the fact that if any recipe that insists with the first ingredient, you have to fight it for your life. I'm already not on board.
I'm a big fan of roast tiger in my house.
Yeah. Similarly, Viper Broth from the Lady's Assistant for Regulating and Supplying Her Table by Charlotte Mason, 1777. Take a large fowl, draw it, take out all the fat and the breastbone, fill the body with parsley, a handful of pimpernel, and a head of endive. Put these into 3 pints of water with a little salt and pepper, stew it on a low fire. Fine, sounds good. Then kill a viper, skin it, and take out the entrails, which to me suggests, again, you have had a live viper just running around the kitchen until you catch and skin it at this point in the recipe.
It's like that scene. Is it Annie Hall where they bring home a lobster and then they get chased or they get by the lobster like that, but with vipers? It's the scene from Annie Hall meets Snakes on a Plane meets MasterChef.
It's great the assumption that you just have a viper in your vicinity.
But my favorite one is from a recipe from The Accomplished Cook by Robert May.
You'd have to be an accomplished cook if you're cooking with viper. You're not a novice cook if you're just throwing snake in.
Yeah, well, this is to make an extraordinary pie or a bride pie of seven compounds. This is for a wedding cake or wedding pie. And again, the recipe is, you know, you're going to make a chicken pie or a lamb pie or a veal pie. And then, you know, it has things like in one, you may put oysters, another you may make of prawns and cockles, a third you may make a bird pie, for another of the pies you may boil artichokes. Fine. And then it talks about the arrangement and presentation of the pies. Now, you may set them on one bottom of paste, which will be more convenient. So essentially, you make all your pies and then you just have one big layer of paste or pastry, which you sit all the pies on top of rather than making individual bottoms for them. Or alternatively, if you set them several, as in if you want to present lots of different individual pies with individual bases, you may bake the middle one in this presentation full of flour. It being baked and cold, take out the flour in the bottom and put in live birds or a snake, which will seem strange to the beholders which cut up the pie at the table. This is only for a wedding to pass away the time.
Scurry, so it's not even to be eaten. It's just a...
This is like the wedding topper. This is like, I've got lots of little pies around, then a central pie cut into it. Oh, surprise, a snake slithers out of it.
Because that's the one thing that I feel was missing from my wedding, was just a little moment in between courses where I got to stand up as the proud groom of that day and go, ladies and gentlemen, unleash the snakes.
Yeah, exactly.
That came later on in the wedding night.
Yay! I mean, I have a small issue with your pluralization. Yes. Now that we are husband and wife, I have quite the reveal for you, my love.
It's a rare condition called Medusa cock.
That is sounds like a strange band name.
Yeah, it really does. And also, like Medusa cock, that assumes that, you know, I'll also turn her to stone.
It was a frigid wedding night, what can we say? Our nominations this week for the world's worst ingredient are Ben's suggestion of super hot chilies, and specifically the Carolina Reaper, Joshua's suggestion of artificial trans fats, and my suggestion of live viper. And I'm not going to lie, guys, I'm delighted that you all came and played, but I am picking live vipers at a wedding as the world's worst ingredient, hands down.
Does it specifically have to be at a wedding?
I think, given that we're talking specifically about an ingredient, that's something that someone has put into this cake in the full knowledge that is going to be cut open and a live viper is going to slither out.
Can I just suggest that actually... the whole dish we've created sounds horrifying. Yeah. Like a live viper with added artificial trans fats with a Carolina Reaper shoved up whatever sort of hole a snake has at the end of it to make it really quite angry for the occasion.
Till death do us part, which might be quite soon once the microphone is sliced open. Before we go, I've got to give you some of the best news of the week, and this comes actually from a few weeks ago, but I've only just found the story, and this is from a Dublin pub, a barman named Frankie Seacle, who works at the Pines pub on Whitehall Road, he was caught on video a few weeks ago carrying a table umbrella, you know, the big table umbrellas you get in outside pubs and things, over the head of a wheelchair user who got caught in the rain while he was leaving the pub.
Oh.
So there's just a lovely still here on the article I'm reading about it where he's carrying this enormous Heineken-themed squared-off umbrella over the pub goer who's driving the wheelchair to his house. And apparently, according to Dublin Live, Frankie was described by his bosses as going above and beyond. One regular drinker described him as a proper gentleman, and lots of people on the video were saying things like, "Our Frankie goes above and beyond. Good man, Frankie, always a gentleman. Well done, Frankie, proves you're a true gentleman." And Frankie's even went on Facebook to say, "Thanks for the nice comments." He assisted, he just wanted to go the extra mile and make the customer feel welcomed, which is lovely. In a world of so many shits, as we've discovered in the last week or two, it's nice to read a nice story like that.
Yeah, that is a lovely story.
Yeah. Before we go, Joshua, where can people find out more about you and your writing?
Oh, okay. So I've got a website, which is www.joshuasegal.co.uk. Seagal is S-E-I-G-A-L. It's quite a unique spelling. So www.joshuasegal.co.uk. I think that's the main thing. I'm also on Twitter, at Joshua Segal. Again, same spelling. It'd be weird if the spelling was different. Amazon, type my name in, or maybe not Amazon, maybe something more ethical. Online you can find books. I write primarily for children, but I do have one book aimed at grown-ups called Advice to a Young Skydiver. I think it sold tens of copies. I do know that a signed copy is significantly an unsigned copy is rarer than a signed copy. put it that way. But yeah, so if you want grown-up poems, I'm in there. Go on my website and have a butcher's.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Well, we're all off to make a new speciality dish for Ben called the Rabbi Swooned. it's essentially just more snakes, guys. I'm sorry. It's more snakes.
And wedding nights.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to Worst Foot Forward. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.